This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Our first guest this hour is among the healthcare professionals at Jesse Brown VA Medical Center in Chicago who help people, veterans in particular, deal with life's traumas, which can cause other major problems. One of them is now known as PTS. Holly Passy is the licensed clinical psychologist at Jesse Brown Veterans Affairs Memorial Healthcare Center, which is located in Chicago. If you, maybe you've passed it. It's in the medical district, and she is in charge of dealing with matters psychological, so to speak. And we are glad to have you with us on Regionally Speaking today, Holly.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we have asked you to talk about the topic of what is known now, and we say now, as PTS, probably better known as PTSD. And of course, that's just the abbreviation for the term for post-traumatic stress disorder. Why did the D get dropped?
Well, I have to say that in our formal diagnostic code for psychologists... Mm-hmm.
That's the DSM and yes. A bunch of Roman numerals after.
Yeah. DSM-5. We're right. On number 5 now. So it's still listed there as post-traumatic stress disorder, but my understanding is that many veterans advocacy groups or mental health destigmatization movements have advocated for the dropping of the D disorder. I think in an effort to normalize the idea that many people experience traumatic events and that this is, you know, oftentimes the reactions of post-traumatic stress are understandable reactions to an extraordinary stressor. Right.
I know, in fact, that brings up the topic here. I guess what most people, when they relate PTS with veterans, they seem to think combat duty. Of course, we know that it all kind of got started from the old World War II term, maybe World War I term for that matter, shell shock.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the very global review of this, I suppose. It's not what it really is, though. And as you mentioned, it could be any number of things that could create this type of situation for anybody, but in particular here, veterans dealing with what they have experienced during their service.
Yeah, so I think that a lot of times we associate post-traumatic stress with veterans because that was a very visible example of it and,
right.
And very tied to our history in this country. And so the formal diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder came about in 1980. And that was as a result of a lot of, I think, combat veteran advocacy to have their condition recognized. However, that there are many types of traumatic stressors out there in the world, from car accidents to sexual assault to child abuse to really anything that threatens death or physical injury, which can be almost an infinite list. Exposure to a war zone as a civilian could
right.
lead to post-traumatic stress.
Yeah. And I know that it's also
right.
It's also associated with the fact that it may be a trauma of some kind that I guess it can lead on to all kinds of different problems. And I know that it's very normal for some things that people may experience after experiencing such an event of some sort to have like upset memories. Maybe they feel on edge when they're with people, even family members, I guess, could happen, mm-hmm. or have trouble sleeping, I imagine, too. There are all kinds of ways that can manifest itself, can't it?
That's right. So in the first few months after experiencing a traumatic event, many of those things that you mentioned are normal and expectable reactions. When it gets past 3 months and we're going on to 4 months and 6 months and those reactions are still persisting, then we may consider, is this a more chronic form of post-traumatic stress? If those initial symptoms in the first few months aren't getting better over time, then we start considering, you know, maybe treatment will help. Maybe this is a post-traumatic stress condition that's going to be more chronic.
I think that I noticed here, too, that this is a situation where it could basically happen to anyone, and it is not a sign of weakness by any means, is it?
No, it's not, and that's a big thing that comes up with veterans is the idea that you would have an emotional struggle, and this is part of the stigma around post-traumatic stress. I think in military culture, many are given the idea that they're near invincible, that, you know, if you're not totally fine after some of these experiences, then it means you have failed as a person in some way. And that's, you know, very contrary to what we understand about this condition in the mental health world, which is, you know, it's really not indicative of a personal weakness as much as it is, you know, the impact of the traumatic event itself. And so there's a lot of work and treatment that has to be done around shifting how people view this condition, and really any mental health condition, I think. Many people still view it as a personal weakness rather than a condition that is very treatable and nothing to be ashamed of.
I know this may seem to be a very simple question to ask, and it's not a very simple answer, and I'm sure that even, as you say, the DSM-5 goes into much, much more detail about this, but I guess the question would be for the layman or laywoman, what would be the symptoms of PTS?
Well, there's a very long list. So I'll try and summarize that for you. One is the first thing that we look for when we talk to people who present with symptoms of post-traumatic stress is we need to establish what the event was that was experienced. We need to establish that the person experienced actual or threatened death or serious injury, things of that nature, because many mental health conditions can look similar. So post-traumatic stress can sort of look like depression. We need to establish what the stressor was. But then after that, there are four clusters of symptoms that characterize post-traumatic stress. The first are intrusion symptoms, which, you know, are your classic, what you think of when you think of post-traumatic stress, like flashbacks, intrusive memories, things like that, where the event intrudes on the person's mind in many different ways. Second are avoidance symptoms. So those are, you know, the cliche or the typical thing, like not wanting to be around fireworks or not going to fireworks shows because they sound like ordnance. That can manifest in many ways. It could be not going certain places, not wanting to feel certain feelings associated with the event, not wanting to have conversations about it, or really be exposed to any internal or external reminders of the event, and
yep.
Really organizing your life around not confronting those triggers.
In fact, we're getting close to another one of these times of the year with the 4th of July holiday coming up here. I know that's always been the concern that veterans always face, that if they are suffering from PTS, they have that fear because it's too much of a reminder of what their combat duty was like.
Absolutely. And so you can understand why someone would have avoidance symptoms and not want to be confronted with those things. And I guess that leads me into the third cluster, which are the hyperarousal symptoms, which are the shots of adrenaline that people will get when exposed to a trigger or a reminder. It's the not being able to sleep or not being able to calm down, feeling like you have to be constantly on guard all the time. So that's the third cluster. And then the fourth cluster of symptoms are negative alterations in mood, which start to look more like depressive symptoms, like losing interest in things you used to enjoy, not being able to feel close to people, impulses to isolate. And that's kind of the part of post-traumatic stress that starts to look a lot like depression.
And I mentioned, too, to add as well, too, that probably also borders on paranoia. When you get somebody who's in such an extreme situation, they say they don't trust anybody. They feel the world is dangerous. It's not a safe place to be in.
Absolutely, and I think that's one thing that is, you know, maybe hard for significant others to grasp is the real sense of danger and mistrust, both of the world and of other people around. And I think one has to really empathize with where that comes from. When you're living in, say, a combat zone that's permeated with danger all the time, you can't just turn that off. And at a certain point, that perception of danger all the time was really essential to survival. But it gets difficult to just choose not to look at things that way anymore. It's not that easy.
What are some other problems that people that have PTS might experience?
Sure. Well, a big one is substance use or abuse. You heard the list of symptoms I just described, which are all very unpleasant. So many times people will try and numb those by using their substance of choice.
Right.
So that's a frequent co-occurring condition.
That also kind of edges into the problem we all face now, and is such a dramatic problem with the opioid crisis, opioid addiction.
Absolutely.
Whether you happen to have been treated for pain management, it's turned out to be a convenient way to kind of avoid the problems.
Absolutely, and I I think, you know, you get, if you think about it this way, you could have somebody who was both physically injured and emotionally traumatized in a combat zone, and they're prescribed opiates to deal with the physical pain, but then it also becomes a very attractive option to deal with the emotional pain, too. And you can see how that easily happens.
I would imagine, too, that besides having addictions of some type or another, or whatever it may be, if somebody has a problem with a relationship at home, or worse yet, if they have employment problems, if they have PTSD, certainly makes problems even worse.
Absolutely, and I think the exact combination of those things is hard to say. Like, are the employment problems related to the PTSD, or are they an extra thing that's just making it more difficult to deal with? And I think that's one thing I would say about, you know, the strength of a VA as a mental health treatment system is that we do not just individual therapy sessions, but we have a whole host of case management resources. We have access to couples therapy to help address the really many ways in which this affects a person's life.
We're talking with Holly Passy, who is the licensed clinical psychologist at the Jesse Brown VA Medical Center in Chicago, about the issue, the problem, almost of epidemic proportions for some, of PTS, as is known, what normally known as PTSD in the past. Holly, what... Make another simple question with a complex answer, I suppose. Will people that suffer from PTS get better?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, in some ways it can be a chronic thing that people deal with, just because we don't yet have the technology or the method to take away bad and upsetting memories. But we do have many effective and evidence-based treatments in the VA that actually there's a large research base that show improvement with treatment for PTSD. And so I think, you know, the more people are engaged in treatment, the more open and honest they can be with their mental health providers, the more we can respond in a way to guide them towards what is going to help improve the condition. I think in my experience as a psychologist, people are really ambivalent about treatment, and they feel weak, as we've discussed. And so oftentimes they're not engaging with the resources, and that tends to make the problem more chronic when people aren't receiving the help. Mm-hmm. But we have good data that if you receive the help that and are consistent with it, that this is a condition that can greatly improve.
You kind of mentioned here, at first, one of the two ways, I guess, to help try to treat PTS, which is with psychotherapy, a chance to talk with a counselor, a professional that can help a person get through their problems, identify more of what their problems may be. And of course, the other one is medication, which everybody knows about. As we say, sometimes it leads into other addiction problems, too, which kind of turns into this very vicious and nasty circle, a cycle of life, I suppose.
It can, but, that's more of a risk with things like opioid medications, which are not mental health medications.
Right.
Those are pain medications. So, you know, working with the psychiatrist to find the right medication for your symptoms and the right dosage can really be helpful. But I want to emphasize that it's not going to be one thing that fixes it. It's not going to be, you know, I found the right pill, or it's usually a combination of things. Maybe medication, maybe psychotherapy, maybe we need to connect the person with some social support if they're feeling isolated. So it really is a more holistic approach than I think sometimes people have in mind when they think about this.
Does it give some people hope once they get involved in talking with a counselor and getting maybe some additional assistance with the right kind of medications to maybe deal with the problems that they may have left with the service with, or maybe that had developed and sometimes even years later?
Sure.
These things can happen. That seem to be a way to offer some hope to people that may have suffered or may be suffering from PTS?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, what I've observed is that receiving assistance, in the form of psychotherapy or something else, it's not right away a very easy process. And that's because in therapy, you know, you're asked to look at very, very painful things that have occurred and still haunt you in some way. And so initially, people don't, believe it or not, people don't always feel very good about that. It's very difficult to come in and talk to a therapist who's a perfect stranger about these very difficult things. And so usually it takes a little bit. It takes a little getting comfortable with that for the person to start to feel hopeful or just start to see changes. So anybody out there listening, I would say it may be uncomfortable, but stick with it because it gets better from there after the initial challenge.
Now we know in the case of the VA healthcare system that the outpatient clinics like the one in Crown Point, as well as the main facility, the Jesse Brown Medical Center in Chicago, have a lot of people that are very experienced and are willing to help out, and they've tried to do the best they can with veterans, don't you?
Yeah, we, day in, day out, we try and do the best we can, for sure.
Holly Passy is the licensed clinical psychologist with the Jesse Brown Veterans Affairs Medical Center, which is based in downtown Chicago. Holly, thank you for this. It's a very enlightening conversation, and we appreciate the help, and hopefully this will enlighten some other people if they have problems or if they have family members that have problems to get them off to the road to recovery. Well, I hate to say that, but certainly a way to enlightenment and to be able to deal with their problems better. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
An increasing number of Indiana police and fire departments are using drone technology to help navigate emergency situations. It's part of a growing national trend. According to the Center for the Study of the Drone at Bard College, the number of public safety agencies with drones has increased to more than 80% in the past year. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier tells us that their success has other industries looking to drones for solutions.
People expect to hear sirens when police respond to an emergency. But there's another sound Noble County residents are growing used to. That powerful whirring sound is coming from one of the Noble County Sheriff's Department's two drones. It's not much larger than a backpack, but it can travel hundreds of feet in the air and give police a perspective they didn't have before.
I can't overstate how much value and how much of a resource multiplier it has been for us.
That's Shafter Baker, the chief pilot for the department. He says they didn't have access to an aircraft of their own before buying the drones in 2016. It would cost nearly $400 an hour to hire a helicopter to aid in an investigation. But the department can operate a drone for about $20 an hour. Deputy Brandon Cordes says it's not just cheaper, but more efficient.
There's no standing by and waiting for the state police to be contacted to bring a helicopter out.
The drone operators use a controller outfitted with a large display screen, which allows them to see what the drone is seeing. The bird's eye view is useful for everything from analyzing a crash site to finding a missing person. Cordes says he realized the power of the small devices the first time he went out on a call with one. A child got off a school bus but never came home.
So we went out and flew around the area. We cleared probably 6 square miles in an hour.
But some Hoosiers worry about police and fire departments using drones. That's something Captain Michael Pruitt with the Wayne Township Fire Department says he experienced firsthand when the department announced it was starting a drone program.
There was a lot of uproar over privacy issues with the drones.
State law dictates how emergency responders can fly drones. Police and fire investigators have to obtain a search warrant in order to use them, unless it's an emergency situation. And Pruitt says most of the calls his department responds to are emergencies.
In the last 3 years, we've covered just about everything possible with the drones. We've conducted search and rescue operations like went on with the incident involving the young boy in Columbus, missing kayaker in Bartholomew County.
Pruitt says he expects drones will eventually become a tool every fire department has. And Indiana State University sees potential far beyond emergency responders. It started the state's first bachelor's degree in unmanned systems a few years ago. Sam Morgan is an instructor for the program.
We create individuals that can go from I call it the landscaper model, where they have a truck and a drone and they'll take whatever job they can get.
Students learn how to build and repair the drones. Then they get hands-on experience flying them in a variety of missions.
We've got a couple students working for a roofing company that has started to use drones with software that'll automatically detect hail damage.
Morgan says there's no shortage of jobs for students, and he expects the demand to only increase as more public sector companies turn to drones to do things they otherwise can't. For the Noble County Sheriff's Department, it's a no-brainer. The drones are cheaper, faster, and help keep officers out of harm's way. Baker says he only has one complaint.
I wish we would have had the drones a lot sooner than we actually have them.
He regularly fields calls from other emergency responders who are looking for guidance in starting their own drone programs. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
This is Quantum Leap Soundbites, brought to you by Indiana Humanities. This series is part of Indiana Humanities' Quantum Leap Initiative, which invites Hoosiers to explore and celebrate the spirit of possibility and problem-solving that occurs when we bridge the humanities with science, technology, engineering, and math. Soundbites is sponsored by J.P. Morgan Chase. In this week's episode, we are exploring how B Corp, a Bloomington tech startup, is innovating in an industry that isn't usually associated with technology. Beekeeping. Meet Ellie Symes, a 23-year-old with a bachelor's and master's degree from Indiana University Bloomington, and founder of the Bee Corp, which has won several grants and awards throughout Indiana for its innovation and commitment to social good. Ellie and her two partners, Simon Kuntz and Wyatt Wells, founded the company in 2016 while they were undergraduates in Bloomington, and Ellie was studying environmental management. She loved the environment, but was also interested in exploring the ways that for-profit companies could be dedicated to social good. One summer, she was looking for an opportunity, something new and different, and she wound up as the apprentice to an Ohio beekeeper. While spending her summer caring for bees, she fell in love with them. She also learned how important they are to our world. As an apprentice, she found out that bees are responsible for pollinating one-third of the food we eat. She also learned that bees are endangered and that their loss from our ecosystems would be truly devastating. Ellie created Bee Corp to develop technology-based solutions for beekeepers using data collected from hives. Through the research and development arm of Bee Corp, Ellie and her team created its first innovative technology product for beekeepers, called the Queen's Guard. One of the things that is most important to beehive productivity and health is the presence of a queen bee. If a queen bee is lost, 2,000 worker bees in her hive die each day that she is not replaced. And replacing a queen bee in the natural world takes a lot of time. Too much time to save the poor worker bees. Ellie knew that there could be a way to identify a hive that had lost its queen before thousands of bees began to die. During her data collection and analysis of her many hives, she figured out that after a hive loses its queen, the temperature of the hive drops. Using this information, Ellie created the Queen's Guard, which is a sensor that beekeepers can place on their hives to collect data and, most importantly, instantly alert beekeepers if one of their hives loses a queen. With this high-tech innovation, beekeepers can acquire a new queen for the hive without losing the productivity of their hives. The Queen's Guard has been met by beekeepers with a sigh of relief. In its first beekeeping season on the market, the Queen's Guard notified 11% of customers that their hives had lost a queen. This means that more than 16,000 bees were saved by the Bee Corp in just its first year. Ellie is working on expanding within beekeeping communities across the United States. She has learned that a big fear among beekeepers from the western United States is the safety of their hives from vandalism and theft. In order to combat the pattern of vandalism and theft of beehives, Bee Corp is testing a GPS tracker that can instantly alert beekeepers if their hive is moved. Ellie and her partners, Simon and Wyatt, are no longer students at IU, and yet they have no plans to leave Indiana because of the incredible technology startup environment and resources available to them. Their access to co-working spaces, as well as a network of supportive advisors dedicated to the success of the B Corp, means that staying a Hoosier company is a no-brainer. Ellie and the B Corp story is an incredible blend of the humanities and STEM. Ellie managed to combine her concern for our world's food supply and the environment with a willingness to learn new skills like data collection to create technology to help solve problems that beekeepers in Indiana and beyond have. Indiana Humanities connects people, opens minds, and enriches lives. This has been Quantum Leap Soundbites, brought to you by JP Morgan Chase, and I'm Sandra Burton. This is our last episode of Season 3. If you've been loving Soundbites and you're going to miss us over the next few weeks while we put together Season 4, please consider telling a few friends about us. We'd love to grow our audience. Thank you so much for your help and your listenership, and we'll see you in Season 4.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's time to check in on matters involving gaming, gambling, and the like here in Indiana. And for that, we're turning to the creator and the editor of Indiana Gaming Insight newsletter, Ed Feigenbaum. Ed, with us on a regular basis to talk about what's happening in Indianapolis and elsewhere, including the activities of not only the regulatory agencies that deal with gambling, but also the businesses themselves. Ed, as always, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
If you will, fill us in on I guess, a number of things that are going to be happening in the week ahead, as several organizations are going to be meeting, and some of those are in public meeting, too.
Right. This is going to be a pretty big week for gaming in Indiana. You've got three meetings or events, whatever you want to term them, that will be pretty important in determining the future of gambling activity in Indiana on a few different levels. Basically, what you want to look at are the Wednesday and Thursday meetings of the Indiana Horse Racing Commission and the Indiana Gaming Commission, respectively. Supreme Court oral argument that will prove very interesting. Let me take the Supreme Court oral argument first, because that's a little bit different than the others and kind of a bit more perspective than the other actions that you're going to see later this week.
Okay.
There's been a lot of talk, as you know, and you know, you've had guests on the show as well, dealing with the issue of this couple of months. But there's a case that's kind of been burnishing for a while in the federal courts in Indiana and the Court of Appeals in Chicago that covers the Indiana federal courts, that deals with something that seemed to be very peripheral but all of a sudden became integral to the sports wagering issue. And that's one involving the right of publicity statute here in Indiana. And what happened is that there are a couple of former college student-athletes, including a guy by the name of Nick Stoner, who was a football player at Indiana University, who sued the two major fantasy sports operators, DraftKings and FanDuel, saying basically, you know, you guys are using all of our information, our likenesses, all the statistics, everything about us as part of your games, your operations, your business. You know, we are an important part, an integral part of your businesses. Without us, you could not exist, and we don't get anything from this. So what they said was that, you know, we believe that under the Indiana Right of Publicity statutes, that you guys have to compensate us for our likenesses, for all the statistical information that you provide about us, and for including us in your fantasy sports operations. Well, it got up to the Court of Appeals in Chicago, and the court there said, you know, there's not been a whole lot of litigation about this Indiana Right of Publicity statute, and the cases that everybody keeps giving us here are national cases, and we want the Indiana Supreme Court to explain to us whether they think that, you know, these fantasy sports operations are more like a news-type business where they're putting the statistical information and all this other data out there about the games and everything, as a news organization would, or whether they're, you know, a separate kind of commercial business, if they're really treating the players as the players say, like, you know, cards in a casino, and that they're really the actual product. Without that information, the fantasy sports operators wouldn't have a business. So they asked the Indiana Supreme Court to to explain to them how they would rule on this under Indiana law. And the Indiana Supreme Court said, okay, we will consider this case.
Mm-hmm.
But in the time since the Court of Appeals in Chicago certified this to the Indiana Supreme Court, and the Indiana Supreme Court said, yes, we will look at it, the Supreme Court of the United States came through with their sports wagering decision that essentially left it open to the states to legalize sports wagering. So this became a whole lot more important because the sports betting operations also rely on player information and provision of all these statistics and news and being able to say, hey, you know, how would you like to bet on Andrew Luck this week and how many passes he will complete, or whether Chris Bryant's going to hit two home runs in any game this week, you know, something like that. So the different professional sports players associations, I think there are 9 different ones, signed on to this case as amici curiae and submitted briefs and want to participate in the oral argument later this week. And it's become a real closely watched national issue that's going to essentially play out in the Indiana Supreme Court before it goes back to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit in Chicago. Court ruling nationally.
Does it seem to you, at least, that that if the Indiana Supreme Court hands down a ruling that's going to be in favor, we'll say, of the fantasy sports teams, that this is going to end up being a case, even though it goes, it's going to go to the appeals court here for Indiana, that it's going to end up being something that will show up almost every state in the country?
Absolutely, and that's why the players' associations are kind of glomming on to this. You know, they want to have this ruling kind of direct where everybody else is going on this, mm-hmm. and they want, you know, their players to be compensated for, you know, product, mm-hmm. and without this player information, which the fantasy sports operators and now, you know, some of the casinos who want to get in on the sports wagering business are behind them on, are saying, no, you know, we're just providing, you know, information like any news media operation would, and people can act on that, but, you know, people can also act on box scores and in newspapers and wagering lines that are published in, you know, newspapers and things like that.
Well, it'd be interesting to see how this does turn out when the Indiana Supreme Court takes this matter up here and then sends it back to Chicago. We're talking with Ed Feigenbaum.
Absolutely.
We're talking with Ed Feigenbaum, who's the creator and editor of Indiana Gaming Institute. Indiana Gaming Insight newsletter, and some of the things that are scheduled to come up this week. You mentioned about the Indiana Gaming Commission going to have a meeting. Tell us what they're going to be bringing up this week.
Yeah, the Indiana Horse Racing Commission is meeting on Wednesday, and that'll be followed by the Indiana Gaming Commission on Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of what they're both going to do will overlap. The Horse Racing Commission on Wednesday is going to be considering the buyout of the 2 Centaur horse racing tracks, the Racinos in Anderson and Shelbyville. Entertainment Corporation, the folks that own Horseshoe Casino in Hammond and Horseshoe Casino Southern Indiana, mm-hmm. down in Harrison County across from Louisville. And so they're going to be looking to see if they think that this is a good deal for the horsemen, for the horse racing industry, for the ag equine industry in Indiana, because over the past decade, you know, the ag equine folks and the horsemen in Indiana have really been spoiled by the way that they've been treated by the Centaur, which has been very, very good to the horse racing community and has been a real partner in everything. And so the Horse Racing Commission wants to make sure when it meets on Wednesday that they've got the same kinds of assurances from Caesars that the operations will be continued in the same kind of partnership-type approach that we've seen from Centaur over the past decade or so. And that's not necessarily a real easy lift. You know, you can make promises and things like that, but Caesars is primarily, you know, a casino operation,
yeah.
and they're not really used to operating horse racing tracks. So there are a lot of real hard promises that the Horse Racing Commission wants to see and hear and get signed, sealed, and delivered, you know, with that, you know, the red wax seal and red ribbon or gold ribbon around it, whatever, before they say yes on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, the Indiana Gaming Commission will be considering the same issue, but in the casino context. They're going to be looking at the Caesars buyout of Centaur in terms of the casino or Racino end of things. The two license limit that we've got to apply to horse racing. I think that Caesars will be a good steward of those two operations. And you know what really helps is that, you know, these are not companies coming in from the outside on either end, and that they're both Hoosier operators with good strong records in Indiana. And you know, the commission has been dealing with them, knows their finances intimately, and it's going to be, I think, a pretty easy call in terms of the administrative end. And, you know, it's just the policy end. And I think in the end, the commission approved this proposed buyout. But, you know, they do have some questions for the operators about, you know, how much of the market they're going to be controlling, because essentially Caesars will end up with more than 50% of the state's gaming revenue, the casino revenue, in any given month. Now, as something separate from that, there's also another buyout that the Gaming Commission is going to be on Thursday, and that involves gaming buying out the Pinnacle Entertainment, Inc. properties.
Yeah.
And Pinnacle operates in East Chicago. They're the owners of the Ameristar Casino East Chicago. They're also the owner of Belterra Casino Resort down in Switzerland County in the Ohio, the Cincinnati market.
Yeah.
And Penn National already owns the Lawrenceburg outside of Cincinnati, which is the biggest operator in the Indiana side of that market. And they can't own three casinos. So what Penn National wants to do is to divest itself of one of its properties that it would have after that buyout, to keep the East Chicago property, and they want to keep the property, and they want to divest the Belterra Casino Resort in Switzerland County.
Yeah.
So what they want to do is get permission to sell the Belterra property to the owners of Blue Chip Casino in Michigan City, and that's Boyd Gaming Company. Boyd operates the Michigan City Casino, and Boyd also has the Paradise Casino in Peoria, Illinois, and Boyd just bought a pretty expensive group of Illinois video gaming terminal slot routes. So, you know, they're well invested in both Indiana and Illinois already.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like a better deal, because, and it would make more sense, I would think, too, because you're talking there about owning two casinos just miles apart from each other. When you're talking about Lawrenceburg and all, they're too close together, I imagine. So they probably would feel more comfortable to even though they wouldn't like the competition, but owned by somebody else, they probably would appreciate not having to operate so close.
Yeah, and every casino appeals to a different kind of crowd,
yep.
and even if they're in the same market, and we see that in Northwest Indiana, where a Horseshoe, you know, tries to appeal to the higher rollers, and Ameristar is doing their best to attract a real strong table games business now, and in particular, you know, working through their poker room, and now that the new high limits area that they've moved on land to attract customers for those types of operations. And at the same time, you've got Majestic Star that appeals to a different crowd, and you've got the folks that want to avoid all those casinos and don't want to deal with table games, and you know, they're now headed over to South Bend for the Pokagon Band's Four Winds Casino.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it sounds like it's going to be very interesting to see how these decisions come out here after the meetings this next week, as you say, with the Indiana Horse Racing Commission and the Indiana Gaming Commission, as well as finding out about the hearing involving the Indiana Supreme Court on the matter involving the fantasy sports people. So it'll be interesting to see what comes from all of these meetings coming up here during this week. We've been talking with Ed Feigenbaum, who's creator creator and the editor of the Insight Gaming Insight newsletter. And as always, Ed, thank you for being with us, and we'll hope to hear back from you soon, get your take on if there are any decisions that come out of any of these, how they turn out here. Thank you for being with us today, though.
We appreciate it, Chris, and if people want to find out more information about the newsletter, you can find us at hannahnews.com, H-A-N-N-A-H, news.com.
This is Regionally Speaking. Esports have doubled in size in the last 3 years, and professional athletic associations are now becoming more closely involved. Here's Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman.
Electronic sports, or esports, are where people are paid to play video games while other people watch them. Amateurs and professionals have been playing for nearly 2 decades now, and they have leagues, lots of leagues, multiplayer online competitions all around the world with hundreds of millions of people watching. This year, an estimated 103 million people watched the Super Bowl. By comparison, just a few months later, the League of Legends Midseason Invitational garnered a worldwide audience of 360 million people. That's why the NBA is getting involved. Earlier this spring, 17 NBA franchises recruited 102 players from around the world. They're paid to play a video game called NBA 2K. They will play as digital versions of their real-life teams.
I work and I do something I love every day, so it's a dream come true, you know. It's amazing.
That's 22-year-old Bryant Colon, who is Indiana Pacers Gaming's first-round pick and just moved from Brooklyn to Indianapolis. As with all the other NBA 2K teams, he and his 5 teammates live in the home cities that their teams train in. Each of the players gets a base salary, up to $35,000 with benefits and housing. There's also prize money from tournaments up for grabs. Once a week, each team of gamers travels to a neutral studio to play NBA 2K in person for viewers on the streaming platform Twitch, which is like YouTube but for video games. Clone says it will look familiar to many basketball fans.
It's basketball played in the virtual world. So if you enjoy the game of basketball, you'll enjoy watching the 2K League because it's the same concept.
But will audiences agree? So far, the NBA 2K League's viewership is off to a rocky start. Jordan Fragan, an analyst for the online magazine Esports Observer, says the league garnered respectable viewership for its launch, but then tailed off. That's a problem.
Especially for sponsors, where you're paying for those eyeballs or the potential eyeballs.
And eyeballs pay bills. While gaming and tech companies sponsor many teams, Indiana Pacers Gaming is sponsored by the Indiana National Guard. NBA 2K Managing Director Brendan Donahue isn't worried yet about the numbers because esports is exploding.
It's likely to expected to double in size again in the next couple of years.
Esports is now a $1.5 billion a year industry. If NBA 2K can draw a bigger audience, it can add to the boom. And then there's the potential of a new market. That's important because traditional sports viewership in the U.S. is aging. The NFL's average viewer is 50. The NBA, 42. The average esports viewer, 28 years old, an age highly coveted by advertisers.
We know that the next generation sports fan is not necessarily watching sports the same way that I grew up and watched sports.
Kelly Crosscuff is the president of Pacers Gaming.
But there's enough room in the, you know, in the sports ecosystem for all of us.
While the NBA is the first to dive into esports with sanctioned league play, both soccer and football are not far behind. Both FIFA and the NFL are in the planning phases for esports leagues of their own. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Chapman in Indianapolis.
Lauren's report aired on Morning Edition on June 20th. For Indiana cities, having a good relationship with railroad companies can help generate a lot of business. But trains also clog city streets, making drivers have to wait at their railroad crossings. Indiana Public Broadcasting Charlotte Tuggle reports that the mayors of cities around the state have begun to fight freight trains, which they say have too much power and not enough accountability.
Right now, we have a string to battle a giant. That's Frankfurt Mayor Chris McBarnes driving over a railroad crossing he says is frequently blocked by stopped trains. According to a state law, local governments have the authority to fine a railroad company if a crossing is blocked for more than 10 minutes. So McBarnes has begun urging residents to call the police, who've so far written 3 tickets. Problem is, the fines max out at $500 apiece. That's about 1/1,000,000th of the profits CSX made in the fourth quarter of 2017 alone, a financial slap on the wrist. McBarnes says he's just trying to get the railroad's attention.
What we're also calling is we're calling upon our state legislators to put a law, a stiffer law into place with teeth behind it that gives local communities the ability to go to battle with these people if we need to.
There's already a case before the Indiana State Supreme Court concerning blocked crossings. The Norfolk Southern Railway Company argues the existing state statute is preempted by a federal law, the Interstate Commerce Commission Termination Act, which centralizes regulation at the federal level. The court has yet to rule on the case. Meanwhile, residents of many Indiana communities must find alternate routes around stopped trains.
I might sit here for another 15 minutes, maybe. If it's still not moving, then I'll go around or just figure out something else to do.
Charles Hart works in Crawfordsville and was on his way to the gas station after work when a train stopped and blocked an intersection along his route. He says he used to be stopped 3 or 4 times a week.
This one doesn't bother me as much because this is a side street, but a lot of times they block down at the... Yeah, they block 3 highways, basically, when they stop downtown.
Those stoppages caused traffic to become so congested that Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton set up a camera at the intersection that live streams to his office.
Right now, it's pretty calm, other than what they're doing on the south side, which is a problem, but it's not the catastrophe that when they block down here. So it runs in cycles.
But that's not the only problem. Driving around Crawfordsville, Barton says highway rail crossings are also in disrepair.
Look at this crossing. This is a state highway. And you can see the plates are partially gone. I mean, if you hit that on a motorcycle, you're going to be in trouble. Very dangerous.
The mayors say the state isn't doing enough and the railroads are bullies. The freight companies contest the fines, which keeps crossings blocked and in disrepair. 2 problems local government doesn't have the money to fix. The railroad companies, on the other hand, claim any more regulation would hurt business for everyone. The Indiana Department of Transportation's response is the Local Trax Program. That's TRAX, by the way. It's a matching grant program written into last year's multi-billion-dollar highway tax bill, which gives NDOT money to front up to 80% of the cost of improving safety at a highway rail intersection. NDOT spokesman Scott Manning says it's the first step of a long-term solution to reduce the number of problematic at-grade crossings around the state.
There's opportunity for the state, local government, and host railroads to all have skin in the game, to all have a vested interest. We think that'll help maximize the impact.
The other 20% of the funding would come from local governments. Host railroads have the option to partner with municipalities to cover that cost. CSX and Norfolk Southern officials both declined a taped interview for this story. In an emailed statement, CSX says it supports the Local Trax program. And as for the blocked crossings, the company says it has experienced what it calls operational challenges in Crawfordsville and has since made changes to reduce the number of incidents. Company officials say they apologize to residents and are communicating with local leaders about the problem. In Norfolk Southern's statement, the company says its government relations office in Indianapolis hasn't heard any concerns from Frankfurt, but is motivated to keep the trains moving for business reasons. It calls long delays highly unusual and asks residents, who it says should be able to get around trains at nearby crossings, to keep in mind that those trains provide jobs and tax revenue. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Charlotte Tuggle.
And with another edition of Eye on the Arts, here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Eric Brandt, Director of Marketing at the Chicago Street Theater. Eric, you just told me that you have been involved with Chicago Street Theater. And
yeah, with a company. I've been there since I was 17. My first production was Camelot when we were still at the Opera House.
And what did you play?
I was just a page, a flag carrier,
a flag bearer,
spear carrier. Yeah, I was nothing special.
So the organization is a community theater guild.
Well, yeah, that's what we were. Well, we were originally the Valparaiso Little Theater Guild, I think, mm-hmm. and then we reincorporated. I think in 64 or something like that and changed the name to Community Theater Guild of Valparaiso. And then in 1998, we had left the Opera House and found our location on Chicago Street. So mm-hmm. we just thought simplest idea is the best idea and call it what it is. So it's a theater on Chicago Street. So it's Chicago Street Theater.
No, I think that's good. Yeah. It helps to build brand and familiarity.
Well,
and
I think our branding has been very, very strong for like the last 20 years that we've been at this mm-hmm. building. So, we just got done with our 20th season there. So
that's fantastic.
Yeah.
So a tradition at of Chicago Street Theater is to present Shakespeare in the park.
Yeah, it was kind of cool how that all came about. My wife was directing a show in January, I want to say, and they were doing January like through March construction on the Central Park Plaza and the Porter Regional Amphitheater there. And she said, "How cool would it be if we could present Shakespeare and maybe be someone's first experience with Shakespeare or be someone's first experience with theater?" And so it kind of planted this seed that, hey, let's give this big gift to the city of Valpo and the entire community every year by doing a different Shakespeare play in the park. So this is the seventh year for it. So.
And you're doing Much Ado About Nothing.
Much Ado About Nothing. We're doing another classic comedy from Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. Last year was Taming of the Shrew. Mm-hmm. So this year we're pulling the boxing gloves off. And it'll be a little more friendly sparring between Beatrice and Benedict.
Yeah, verbal.
Verbal sparring,
She doesn't actually slug him.
No, she doesn't. Not like Kate. No.
Yes, that Kate, she's unruly. So this is on July 6th and 7th. You do two performances.
We do two performances that are free to the public. And then after it's appeared in the park, it goes back to the theater for four more performances.
Oh, nice.
So a lot of people don't like it's the event atmosphere, I think, that draws people to the park. Plus, they can get up and leave if they get bored with Shakespeare or maybe they get engrossed in Shakespeare because they've got their wine and their lawn chairs out there.
Yeah.
It's a whole atmosphere that we create with a street fair. We have different food vendors. Some of Valpo's best restaurants are down there cooking for us.
Uh-huh.
And then we have a lot of so it's a whole festival atmosphere as it might have been in the time of Shakespeare, but it's not a Renaissance fair. It's kind of updated.
Right.
But there are some people who do prefer to hear every word of Shakespeare, so we invite them to see Shakespeare in the AC at Chicago Street.
Uh-huh.
So it'll run the Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday following the park performance. So that would be the 12th, 13th, 14th, and 15th.
Well, that's good. I'm glad there are more than two performances because that's a lot for local actors to tackle.
Yeah. And it's a big thing to take a set that you've made on your own stage, which mm-hmm. is considerably smaller than what's at the amphitheater.
Yeah.
And basically you've got to get all your actors are putting the setup out at the park and
uh-huh.
then loading it back in the trucks and then putting it back up and loading it back in the truck. So it's a big undertaking, but we've kind of had this learning curve going each year.
And I assume you get a lot of community support.
We do. We get a ton of it from the Valpo Creative Council, who will be partners with us this year. The Northwest Indiana Excellence in Theater Foundation will also have a stage at the Urschel Pavilion and performing different scenes from shows from throughout all Northwest Indiana.
To promote.
Yeah.
Other theaters as well.
Uh-huh.
That sounds like a really wonderful.
Yeah, so we call it, it's where the arts and community come together.
Wonderful. Very inclusive.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. Well, Eric, good luck with Shakespeare
in
the Park, and thanks for coming back to tell us about it.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And you can catch all of the Eye on the Arts conversations on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. Hope you'll be with us tomorrow.